You are listening to the Hiking Radio Network, where we talk the walk with shows by hikers about hikers for everybody.
Mighty Blue on the Appalachian Trail, the ultimate midlife crisis. Join Steve and his guests every week as he staggers from Georgia to Maine.
Welcome back to the show. You are listening to episode number 374 of Mighty Blue on the Appalachian Trail, the ultimate midlife crisis. I'm Steve Adams on Mighty Blue, and we've got another very full episode today. First up, our main guest is Kelly Jaworski, or Birdie. Kelly was the hiking partner of a previous guest. I won't say who yet. I wanted to feature Kelly because, as I've often said, you can hike with somebody else from beginning to end, yet you're going to have your own unique experience. Kelly proves this emphatically, so much so that I started to think about that very issue, and I think I may have opened up possibilities of lots more guests in the future as they share their story after I've heard from their hiking partner. Kelly will be on shortly. Then, our Mighty Blue Class of 23, sadly, loses another member. I catch up with three of them today. First up, we'll hear from Ron Ward, followed by Steve Korterkamp, then Mark Carpenter. One of those is back home, while the other two are still moving on. I know that many of you are still enjoying the incredibly detailed story by George Stephanos, and for me, it's been a pleasure to read, record, and edit. Unfortunately, last week, our show was inexplicably truncated by one of our dynamic ad inserts. As you're doubtless aware, the show now has either one or two ads before I introduce the show, then another one or two after the show ends. Well, the ad company got a little over-enthusiastic last week and cut off the last minute or so when I was mid-sentence. Bloody rude if you ask me. Anyway, several of you pointed that out, so thanks for that. I've re-uploaded the entire show, so all should be well going forward. But for those of you who have already downloaded the show, you were left high and dry. So today, just before the last segment of the book, I've added in the last minute or so before the new segment airs. I hope that's clear, and sorry for the inconvenience. Now let's hear from Kelly Jaworski, or Birdie. Today's guest was the hiking partner on the Appalachian Trail of another of our previous guests. As always, even partners inhabiting the same space on trail will have a different experience. This is Kelly Jaworski, or Birdie. Hey, Kelly, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
And as I said just then, you hiked with one of our previous guests, but we're not going to start there. I want to find out where this kind of desire to, because I know what it feels like, this desire to hike the trail came from. How did it sort of, you know, what was your background in backpacking to start with?
Sure. So I grew up in a small town that was in the foothills of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So the mountains were always there. Loved the mountains. Went hiking a lot as a kid, but not a whole lot of backpacking experience. But I've always known about the Appalachian Trail because of where I grew up.
Did you actually go on it as a kid as well in any way?
Yeah, here and there. And it was one of those things where it's like, wow, this goes all the way from Georgia to Maine. And so knowing that it was such a long trail and such an arduous adventure, I never thought that that would kind of be in my cards. I mean, I liked the mountains and I liked hiking, but taking that on was a totally different perspective there.
Yeah.
So never thought it was in my cards. Never really thought I could do it.
Were you backpacking at the time though, or were you just day hiking?
Just day hiking.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And did you do any overnights at that stage of your life?
I didn't really get into overnights until I was in high school. So again, I knew about the trail when I was a kid, but wasn't really interested in camping in the woods until I was in high school. And then even then it was only a couple nights, here and there. We did Grayson Highlands once. I did Max Patch, kind of the classics, if you will, of the Southern Appalachians.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't until I, was 25 and I was working my corporate job and the company was doing strategic planning. And one of the things that they were asking themselves was their something called a BHAG, which
is a new expression for me, by the way. Excellent expression.
Yeah, which is the acronym for Big, Hairy, Audacious Goal. And so the company was asking itself if it were to set a massive goal for itself, probably unreachable, but still in pursuit of it would be exciting. What would it be? And I was involved in that conversation and I thought to myself, man, I'm 25 and I've never really set a BHAG for myself. Every goal I've set for myself has been attainable. I knew I would attain it. But I never set a goal that was just out there.
Were you unsatisfied with where you were in your life at that time? Or was it just suddenly they encouraged you to just think bigger?
Yeah, great question. I loved my life. I wasn't trying to escape it. I wasn't trying to leave it. I wanted to see if I could put myself out there with something that was really out of my comfort zone.
All right.
And so when I thought about what that could be, I thought about the Appalachian Trail, because it was always something that just seemed so big and so out there and so hard that I really wanted to see if I could do it. So that was my BHAG.
And that was what, 5 years ago, something like that? 5 years ago?
Yeah.
And at the time, was it one of those things where you think, yes, I'm going to do that? Or was it one of those things you said, right, I now need to work out what I'm going to do to make that happen?
Oh, it was definitely the latter. Right. I mean, I'm married. I have a job. We have a condo.
Were you married at the time?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So that's obviously the next question then.
Yeah.
How did your husband react to that BHAG? And by the way, how did you... And I thought about this when I was writing this morning, actually. Uh-huh. How did you phrase it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So we were kind of at a point where when we first got married, he was in grad school and then he went and founded a company. And so for our first years of marriage, I was supporting him financially and also just like stability wise. Mm. And when he got to a good place with his company and where he was, he just kind of looked at me and he was like, wow, thank you for all your support. I wish I could return the favor. In the back of my head, I was like, well.
Yeah, funny you should mention that. So you literally waited for him to say that. And then you said, funny you should mention that. So
yeah, what happened next? Pretty
yeah,
well.
What happened next? Excellent.
And so then I mentioned that, you know, there's this one thing called the Appalachian Trail. I think it'd be really neat to know, really neat to do. I don't think that he was like, sure, yes, you know, I want to support you. If you have something you want to go after, let's do it. But I'm not quite sure if he knew that it was, you know, a 6-month trek that required, you know, like leaving my job and leaving
yes.
society as we knew it.
So by the end of that initial conversation, yes, this is payback. You can go on a 5-day hike or something like that. It's probably what he was thinking in his mind.
I think so.
How do we move on that it was slightly more than that?
I eventually just started kind of educating him on it and talked more and more about it. And it's one of those things, the trail or really any big goal. The more you talk about it, the more it becomes normalized.
I agree. So, that's a great point. And that's when you mention the BHAGs, I have heard that in the past. Of course I have, but not in a way, not for a long time. That was very 80s thinking, to be honest with you, in business when I was in London. We used to talk about that sort of thing. And it was always really reach for the stars, that sort of thing. But you're now growing this in your husband's mind and you're starting to think it's normal. Did he ever think it was normal?
Good question. I still, to this day, I don't think he thinks it's normal. but he knew it was important to me, and so he supported me. But it's even when we look back on it, we're like, wow, that was something. And we really get that perspective when we tell new friends or new colleagues, like, oh, yeah, we did the Appalachian Trail 2 years ago. And you see their faces like, wait, the whole thing, and you were gone for 6 months and you were married, you know, all of these things, and we kind of take a step back and we're like, oh yeah, this was a really big deal.
Yeah, it was a big deal. And it's not a given either. a guy going away, leaving his wife with the situation, or his partner with the situation, or a woman going away, leaving her husband with the situation. Did it? Did you feel selfish at all?
It's a good question.
I try.
I don't know if I felt selfish, but I did feel like I. I knew that he was making a big sacrifice.
Right.
I knew that.
Right.
And that was kind of, there was a little bit of a, I hiked and can probably at a faster pace, than, you know, if I had all the time in the world, mm-hmm. than I would have,
yeah.
because I did have in the back of my mind, he is making a huge sacrifice for me.
Right. And you know what? When I asked that question, I hesitated for quite a long time. And I'm glad you hesitated to answer, by the way. I hesitated because it's not normally a question I ask a man, but a man often volunteers that as a response, knowing that the support of his wife's coming up. So I felt kind of, I'm sure women are out there listening, well, you never ask that of a man. And I probably don't. So yeah. It's terrible how we sometimes view a woman doing this as be in some way different to a man, but it's just not. You're leaving your spouse, whether they're male or female, to look after shit at home, aren't you, really?
Yeah, and it was really interesting because even on trail, I mean, my hiking partner, he had a girlfriend, and there were other guys on trail who were married. And I would get asked often, oh, your husband let you do this?
Yes.
Whereas Stuart never got asked, like, did your girlfriend let you? He got asked, like, oh, what did your girlfriend think about it? But not, oh, she let you. So, yeah, there is definitely a different connotation.
Did you resent that when you spoke to people out on trail?
Well, I'm a bit of a feminist, so part of me was like, I boiled up a bit. Yeah.
Quite right too, by the way. I mean, I feel bad about asking it just now, by the way. It was a good question because I was going to lead into the fact I felt almost apologetic about asking a sexist question, but kind of there is that mindset out there. So that was interesting to me. And you've already mentioned your hiking partner, so we better say who it is. Tell us about meeting Stuart or Puppy Love.
Yeah, Stuart or Puppy Love. So I met Stuart. We're both from Charlotte, North Carolina. And within Charlotte, there's a brewery called Blue Blaze.
Yeah.
So it's AT themed. And when I got serious about the AT, it was the same time that he was getting serious about the AT. So we both independently showed up at the brewery because
sure.
they would coordinate something called Trail Talk, which is just people get together and talk about the trail.
By the way, at that stage, were you planning on going by yourself or were you actually looking for a partner to hike with?
I completely envisioned doing the trail by myself.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I met him there and we went to that trail talk every single Monday night for a year. And so we got to know each other. We were both planning an April start date. And again, I was expecting this to be on my own. And then one day he just kind of asked, he was like, hey, what if we start together? No expectation to finish together, to do the whole thing together.
Sure.
But what if we just started together? And I thought, sure, let's do it. It'd be great to have a familiar face on trail.
And did you ask your husband's permission? No. I'm joking, but so when you went back home that night, you said, this guy has asked me to start the AT with him. Had he met Stuart by then? Did he come along to these talks?
He had not met Stuart by then.
All right, okay.
And so when I approached James, that's my husband's name, and said, you know, Stuart, he heard about him, of course, because it's a close community.
Sure.
Stuart asked me if we wanted to start together. I'm kind of torn, honestly, because again, I was envisioning doing this on my own, but at the same time, it is nice to have a familiar face. What's your take? And he said, he was like, personally, I think it's a great idea. And I would appreciate that if you did start with him, because then I know that someone is looking out for you. If you were to fall off a cliff, there is someone there who knows that Kelly fell off a cliff.
Bless your husband for that. That is not that's not everyone's attitude. I know it isn't, because I've spoken to a number of people on this show, as you can imagine. And I know they haven't had a similar reaction. So that was great that he took that on. So how did you prepare for the AT? Not only your gear, but also the plans you made with your husband. Because I know you actually bought a camper van, didn't you? We lived in a camper van. So tell us how that all went.
Yeah, sure. So for prepping for the AT, it was the trail talk at Blue Blaze. And then I watched a lot of YouTube, a lot of through hiker YouTube.
Of course, yes.
Learned so much. And then I did a couple shakedown hikes with folks from the Blue Blaze crew.
Right.
And then as far as the camper van, that was actually pretty spontaneous of us. James came up with the idea and immediately I loved it. Cause I was like, oh yes, I would, you know, whatever facilitates you and me being able to see each other along the trail, let's do it.
Sure.
And so it was a pretty spontaneous decision. It worked out that there was someone selling a camper van in Charlotte for the price that we were looking for. And so we just went with it and rolled with it.
So how long did you live in the, or how long did he live in the camper van effectively?
Yeah. So the way that we did the AT was we split it up into three chunks. Hmm. The first chunk was basically the southern portion. So Georgia to like mid Virginia. And at that point, most of the trail was within a 3-hour drive of Charlotte. And so what he would do is he would work, at home in Charlotte and then during the week. And then on the weekends, he would drive the camper van to wherever I was on trail. And then we would just spend the weekend in the camper van. He would slack pack me. He would feed me. He would, you know, provide support for me.
Sure.
And so it's just weekends. The entire trip was just weekends really in the van. And then the second chunk of the trail, his family lives in Virginia or in Maryland. And, so from mid Virginia all the way up to northern Pennsylvania, that was like 2 months, you know, he lived at his parents' house and they supported me when I came through the mid Atlantic and
He works from home then, does he?
Yes, he works remotely.
Is that amazing how our approach probably to COVID originally has enabled people to set up lives in a different fashion to people only 5 or 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
And in many ways, in your case, it's massively beneficial for you, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. And I mean, there were several days that he was driving around a small little town in Virginia or North Carolina trying to find signal so he could hop on his hotspot to then get on the call.
That's a great way to think about living, though. What a fantastic way.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'm a 70-year-old guy. This is not something I could realistically do, I don't think, anymore. But, man, what a great way to live. And what about the gear? Did you have the gear already or did you have to get everything new for the AT?
I had to get everything.
Okay.
And the Blue Blaze crew really, really helped me.
Oh, really? In what way? Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So the Blue Blaze crew really helped with gathering all my gear. There was a lot of conversation around gear, like everything from the cheapest Walmart gear all the way to the lightweight stuff or ultra lightweight stuff. And some of the Blue Blaze crew were former AT through hikers, so they really had a good pulse on what was needed and what was not needed on the trail. So I really just ran my thoughts and ideas through them. They came with suggestions. There was one guy, particularly Houdini. He hiked in, I want to say 2019 or 2018. And he was kind of a gear nerd. And so I always came with my ideas to him. And then we had a couple shakedown hikes with the crew that helped me figure out, okay, I need a lighter sleeping bag or I need a better set up.
And because James, your husband James, was coming to meet you, was it every weekend pretty much, or you would see him every weekend in the camper van?
No, it averaged out to probably over the course of the entire trail, averaged out to probably every 2 to 3 weeks.
Oh,
because
right.
Once we got farther north, it got harder.
Sure, sure.
But in the south, it was about every weekend.
So the great thing about that, I guess, is you could leave stuff on the camper van. And you could pick up stuff in the camper van, couldn't you? So that's a really good restocking process as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. So the couple weeks leading up to the trail, we did the whole go to Sam's Club, buy everything in bulk. And then I created resupply bags basically for the entire trail.
Nice, nice. Mm-hmm. And you're a runner, you told me before when we spoke. Do you think the skills that you've learned as a runner are able to translate in any way into a through hike?
Definitely. So, I mean, I had the physical aspect of it. First of all, at that point I could walk out the door and be able to run 8 miles, no problem. And so I didn't have to train.
I find it exhausting to drive 8 miles.
I didn't have to train physically for the trail in that sense, but the biggest advantage that came from hiking, or sorry, from running, that transferred over to hiking, was the mental aspect of it. I had experience with the idea of you're in the middle of a long run and it stinks, it's hard, you're out of breath, you're thirsty, you gotta use the bathroom, you're tired. But then somehow you find yourself at the end of that long run and you did it. So even though it was hard and you thought that you were at a breaking point, you were always at the end of a long run and you're like, yeah, I did that.
Is it a bit like what you said earlier on about thinking about it and making it happen? You said about it normalizes the idea, thinks about it. So is that the same sort of approach you take when you're running?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Yeah.
Okay. And you started early April, which I believe was Stuart's birthday. How did the two of you work out for those early miles? Because it's easier to chat to somebody in a bar and have a drink with them and so on. It's not quite the same as spending 24 hours a day virtually with them on a trail. Or did you hike apart during the day and just meet up in the evenings?
Yeah, so good question. It changed over time. So we started on April 3rd because the date, if you wrote it out, would say 4-3-2-1 and go. So that's why we started on that date.
All right. Yeah.
And when we hiked, we more or less hiked together. We hiked at the same pace.
That's lucky, and, you know. That's lucky.
Yes. Yeah, we learned that on one of the shakedown hikes. Nice. That we're similar hikers. So we hiked at the same pace, and we took the same kind of breaks, and we were at the same mileage. There are very few times where he would want to go 15 and I'd want to go 12. That happened very rarely. So we were together a lot.
Wow. And then you had those weekends to help keep you going, and I'm sure they did.
Mm-hmm.
Did they ever feel for either, and I'm not really asking for Stuart, I'm asking for you, obviously, did they ever feel like they were interrupting your hike? Did you ever feel like you were really going and really in a rhythm and so on, and then think, oh God, I've got to meet up with the van this week because I'm really going well? Did it ever feel like an interruption, or was it a really welcome part to your hike?
Sometimes it felt like interruption,
right.
Sometimes James would come up and Stuart's girlfriend wouldn't,
right.
Or vice versa. Stuart's girlfriend would come up and James wouldn't. So we had to accommodate for that. So sometimes it felt like an interruption, but it was more so felt as we get to spend time off trail. We get to relax. We get to see our loved ones. And so it was more often than not a very positive, welcomed.
It sounds great. It sounds great, to be honest with you. But yeah, you know what I mean about it being possibly feeling like sometimes an interruption.
Absolutely.
And naturally, and I don't know if he's contacted you about this, I asked Stuart to throw a few questions in as well. He wanted you to tell me about state line dancing.
Well, I mean, as you know, every time you cross a state, it's this huge achievement.
Especially from Virginia into West Virginia.
And so we would always find a way to really celebrate that. And so, for example, when we got to the Virginia state line, we sang Meet Virginia by train. And we would use our hiking poles as microphones, and we would just celebrate the fact that we made it to another state and just soak it in. Because, again, it becomes normalized in a sense of like, oh, I made it to another state, and, you know, it's another day on the trail. But we just walked an entire state. We need to celebrate that.
I totally agree. And I think celebrating anything in life that feels significant to you is worthwhile every single time. So using your hiking poles and microphones, that's an excellent idea. They don't work, you know, just so you know. And I'll come back to a couple more questions in a minute. And I know that you met up with another guy who joined your tramley, the mayor. And actually, Stuart did ask about this. Is what's it like being a female hiking in a two-guy tramley and you're the only female? Or did it just feel you were three hikers?
Yeah, it did. I mean, it was kind of a dynamic I felt all along the trail. There's just female representation is lower. So by the time that we met up with the mayor and really committed to hiking with him, I was kind of used to being one of the only girls.
Yeah.
And so I guess it didn't feel... it didn't feel as segregated as it might. But there are times, I mean, we were actually, I was just texting with Stuart and the mayor the other day about every time I wake up in the middle of the night to pee now, I think to myself, I am so glad I'm not getting out of my sleeping bag, out of my tent, stepping out into the cold and peeing in the dirt. And they were like, yeah, that's why you get a Gatorade bottle. And it's like, well, yeah. I don't have the anatomy for that. You know, so there are times that we definitely had a different experience because of male-female dynamics, but I wouldn't say that it felt like I was hiking with two guys all the time. Well, but sometimes it did.
Funnily enough, I've mentioned in the show in the past that when I started in 2014, there were about 75% of the trail was men and 25% women. Mm-hmm. By the end, it was about 50-50 mm-hmm. because men are dumb and they make mistakes and they fall over and they run and they do dumb things, you know. And the women are more solid and steady and they go with their hike and say, at the end, at Katahdin, it's 50-50. It was amazing to me. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that in 2019, when I went the second time, there was much greater representation of women, and that was great for the trail itself, I'm sure. And did anybody kind of emerge as the leader of that group of three and make decisions on and where you go that day, or was it every night you sit down to dinner and say, well, what are we going to do tomorrow? Did somebody step up and say, well, I think we should go 14 miles or whatever it is?
I think it was really a group effort. Sometimes I took the lead on logistics, like, okay, we are 35 miles from town and, you know, we are 2 days away, sure. You know, let's look at the shelter and figure that out. And sometimes Stuart took that on and sometimes the mayor took that on. So it was really a split responsibility, which I'm grateful for.
I'm sure. And by the way, we can hear one of the reasons you're back home now, by the way, which is great. But we'll talk about your baby in a minute. Stuart also wanted me to ask a question that I didn't really understand, though it may have more resonance for you. He wrote, wearing contacts on a through hike. A weird one, I know, but for me it was a lot. Ha ha. Mm-hmm. What's that about?
It was kind of a challenge that was unanticipated, wearing contacts on the trail.
Was it? Why?
Well, you have to have clean hands every time take them out. Right. And so that's hard to maintain clean hands, and then you have to carry the little bottle of solution, and it was just a logistical thing that I didn't expect to be as hard.
Do you ever lose any?
No, I did not lose any contacts.
Well done. You. But, yeah. Yeah, and I never thought that would be an issue, but of course, clean hands, absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And you may have a different take on this, but he also wrote, for the last month or to 2 months, she really didn't want to go on. Emotionally, it was weighing on her, and I guess that's to do with your husband. What pushed her through, and what helped her keep moving and finish?
Well, hearkening back to earlier, I knew that James was making a big sacrifice for me, and I felt like I kind of owed it to him and to me to finish. Right. Owed it to me, obviously, because I set that goal for myself, but James was putting a lot of effort and time and sacrifice into making this successful for me. So if I quit, if I gave up, it was more than just me who was going to be bummed.
That's a weight to carry, you know. That's interesting. I'd not thought of it like that, but yes. Once again, I don't think many men think that at all. At all. You know, they think, well, I'll try my hardest and I'll do my best and go home when I go home. But that's interesting. You felt that weight as well. And tell us about Katahdin from your perspective. What was that day like for you?
Ooh, well, weather-wise, it was unfortunate. We asked the ranger the day before we were going to summit what the weather was going to look like. Because we could see that it wasn't going to be great. And he said, it'll be in the 50s and it'll be cloudy as you're going up, but then it'll dissipate in the afternoon and you'll be fine. And we're like, great, that works. And it couldn't have been more wrong.
I saw the pictures.
Yeah, it was really horrible, like sideways rain, mist, spit. the whole
time. It's epic, though. Is everything is epic?
It was. It was kind of like I want both experiences. I want that because it was epic, but I also want the clear blue sky day where you can see for miles. And in fact, you know, we went up and we didn't really have any views at all. Mm. And later that day, I showed James summited with me. I showed him a picture of what the top of Katahdin looks like. And he was shocked. He was like, that's where we were? That could have been our view? And I'm like, yeah, you didn't get to see any of it. I guess we'll have to come back.
That's fit. He must have been a fit guy to be able to hike Katahdin. Like everybody goes southbound, hikes up Katahdin. I know. Mm-hmm. I still can't get my head around that. But, right. So he came up with it. It must have been very special. And were you glad when it was over? Were you partly sad? Or did you think back to the BHAG that I've accomplished my BHAG? Because for me, the word accomplished was what I felt both of my hikes. I felt I'd really accomplished something. Did that feel the same way to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought it was very fitting that James was there. Because again, this was a team effort. And we had, so we all, Mayor Stewart and I all, summited, you know, on the same day, but James and I summited probably 4 or 5 minutes earlier than Stewart and the mayor.
Sure.
And so we had that moment at the sign together. And actually, because the weather was so bad, the visibility was probably like 10 or 15 feet. So we didn't even know that we were at the sign until we were at the sign.
Oh, wow. That must be something.
And as soon as it came into view, James has a video of this, I actually kind of fell down and started just crying from relief, accomplishment, all of the feelings. And he had to kind of help me for the last 10 feet to get to the sign because it was just so overwhelming.
Oh, it doesn't count then. there was a bloke who ran this is totally off topic, a bloke who ran the marathon in 1908, I think it was. He collapsed just before the line. Two officials helped him up about 10 feet across the line. He was disqualified. So there you go. Bad luck.
There we go. Yeah, I guess I'll do the whole thing all over again.
Yeah, that's right. So it must be very special to share that moment with him. And actually, for him to help you across the line, as it were, was emblematic of what he'd actually done for the whole 5 or 6 months. So that was fabulous. So you came back home. Did you find yourself settling straight back into domesticity, or was it difficult for you to readjust when you got back home?
I was ready to get back into the real world and to have the conveniences of modern life. Our situation was a little different when we got back home because we knew at that point that we were going to be moving from Charlotte, North Carolina to New York City.
Wow. That's a bit of a change.
It's a huge change. Well, you go from like Charlotte and then the trail and then you go to New York City. There's a little bit of whiplash there.
That's why you've got bikes on the wall behind you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a big place.
And so when we got home, there is a part of us where the adventure was still going to continue because we were going to now make this huge move to New York.
Sure.
And I'll say that I don't think I would have been able to move to New York City if I hadn't done the trail, because the trail taught me that I can do things.
Do stuff.
I can, yeah. And New York City has always been so big and different.
That's an often understated effect of the trail.
Yeah.
It makes you realize there's nothing you can't do, because there are lots of things I can't do, but there's a whole lot of stuff I can do now which I never thought I could do, and I'm sure you feel exactly the same. And in fact, you must have really settled down a bit once you did move, because you got a baby now. So tell us about the baby.
Yeah, so she is 3.5 months now, and her name
is
actually...
By the way, you look fabulous, just so you know. For a 3.5 month baby, yeah.
Thank you. Her name is Pippa Katahdin, so her middle name is Katahdin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's really to inspire her to set big goals and to go after them, regardless if people think that you're crazy or if you want to do something, do it.
Yeah.
And actually, when I was at the top of the mountain, I thought to myself, my next adventure is starting a family. And I had said that throughout the trail. You know, people ask, oh, what are you going to do after the trail? What are you going to do after the trail? And my answer was, I want to start a family.
You know what? That is a big, you call it big, hairy, audacious goal. I used to call it big, hairy arse goal. So are you one and done? Because if your husband doesn't like hiking, you've got a baby at home, and I think he's paid you back for grad school. Will you get out there again, do you think?
That's a great question. I go back and forth on this. I want to do some trails with Pippa. I think it would be really fun to have that culture of family backpacking, family hiking. I'll have to get James on board because, again, he's not the biggest like backpacker. But I saw a lot of mother-daughter duos on trail or father-son duos. And I thought that would be really neat to have that experience with our children or just my children.
Need to be a 2,200 mile hike, does it either?
No, it doesn't. No. And in fact, there's a trail here about 2 hours away. It's in South Jersey and it's called the Batona Trail and it's 50 miles and it's flat. And I think that would be, even if I'm carrying her in a little kid backpack, I think it would be really fun to do that with her. I don't have it in me, I don't think, to do another 6 month trek, leave everything behind.
But I did it.
Yeah, and then you did it again.
What's that all about? Well, look, I tell you, I think you've proved the point that I could have one hiking partner who hikes pretty much all the time with another hiking partner. And you've both told entirely different stories. Mm. And I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with us. And I hope it does inspire people to get BHAGs going, because I'm definitely going to use that expression, but I prefer my version of it than the audacious.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Cheers, then. Bye.
Bye.
I told you a story would be different from Stuart's. We all have separate perspectives, and while we may walk the same path on the same day, our perspective informs our story. It's a useful lesson to learn in pretty much every walk of life. And you probably noticed that I didn't edit out the long pause she took when she considered my question as to whether or not doing the hike was selfish. I know it's a question I've rarely asked men, although several of them have volunteered the answer, but it occurred to me in the moment, so I wanted a reaction. Next up, we have our class of 23, and we'll start with Ron Ward, who, I'm delighted to say, is not going home this week. Here's Ron.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, Ron, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. And when we last spoke, you were in Gatlinburg. Where are you now?
Damascus, Virginia.
Oh, blimey, you're moving on, aren't you? How are you doing? Yeah. You must be hitting big days then.
I've been getting some 20-mile days.
Why? Don't rush it. It'll still be there.
Yeah, I'm trying to slow it up a little bit. I think in the early days, I was keenly focused on getting to Damascus for trail days. I was trying to, match it up with, I got family coming to visit. And
sure.
As it turns out, I'm solid week early. So
I'm not going to see you there, am I? I'm not going to see you, am I?
No. I'll be there. I'm going to head north and then probably shuttle back from Marion or someplace. But we're planning on being here for the trail days. So
Well, when we
Thursday through Sunday.
When we last spoke, you were in Gatlinburg. And soon after we spoke, you then sent me a picture. You met Bluebird, one of our other class members. Did you recognize each other, or did you start talking and realize you were both part of the Mighty Blue Class 23?
Just struck up a conversation. Hey, what's your name? And I said, Bluebird from New Hampshire. And she said, yeah. I said, are you on the podcast? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, I am too. And so we laughed pretty good at that. And then after, I think the next day, you aired a podcast that had both of our interviews, and we laughed with each other about how different our perspectives were at the time of the interview. You know, she had a tough time.
Oh, yeah.
Had a string of rough patches, and then there's me, that you called I don't know if this is accurate or not, but you said, you know, that I was blissfully enjoying, you know, my time.
Well, you are. You seem to be having a great time.
I'm having a great time. I mean, it's punctuated with some moments of, you know, discomfort, and yeah. I wouldn't call it misery, but there's moments where, you know, it gets tough.
Yeah. And you said that I've got your notes here, so we'll go through those a little bit. You said you've avoided the noro plaguing everybody else. Have you seen a lot of people struck down by it?
Yeah. In the last couple of weeks, particularly around Irwin.
Right. Yeah.
I think it actually started in Hot Springs. Mm-hmm. It seems like there was a big gathering for the hiker festival that weekend. Yeah. I was in Hot Springs, and I was really lucky, Steve. I stayed in a very small bunkhouse off the beaten path. I did not, just for whatever reason. I mean, I don't remember intentionally avoiding anything, but I didn't participate in some of the bigger, you know, parts of the festival that weekend that were going on in some of the other areas, and I got lucky and stayed healthy. But I heard from probably a dozen people that got norovirus, you know, were sick. One guy that I had been hiking around, we actually stayed at the same shelter area, he had to go to the hospital.
Oh my God.
So it was, yeah, wow. So it was pretty legit. And I think that people, you know, in the last 2 weeks have kind of rebounded from it. Although one guy I know, a guy from Germany, he had it tough. Probably 10 days. He was pretty sick.
So. Well, you know, it can be anywhere up and down the train. See, the trail. So you never really know what's going to happen. So you've still got 1,750 miles to catch it in. So good luck with that.
Yeah. I hope I avoid it. I'm trying my best.
And you're saying the message that you saw an enormous rattlesnake on the trail. Define enormous.
Mm. So I took a pretty good picture with a big tree and a 6-inch by 2-inch blaze for perspective. I can share it with you if you're interested.
Oh, but yeah, definitely.
I was, probably mid-morning, 11:30, 11:45, something like that. I was coming out of Standing Bear Farm. You know, there's a pretty decent climb right
there.
Yes. Rocky,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, sandy soil, rocky, lots of pine trees, perfect habitat for the eastern diamondback rattlesnake, which I'm very, very familiar with.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just bebopping along, you know, making my way up this climb, and I heard the rattle. I mean, he just lit up right in front of me, and so I stopped. That's an unmistakable sound.
Yeah.
And it took me probably a 3 count just to find him. And he was 5 or 6 feet in front of me. I would have stepped on him.
Wow.
No doubt about it. I would have walked right up on him. But he was headed up the trail ahead of me. And I just stopped, obviously, and just let him kind of get out of the way.
Yeah.
And, you know, he moved on, quit rattling, and calmed down, never coiled up or anything like that, never even looked at me. But
they want nothing to do with us. They don't want anything to do with us at all, do they?
They don't. You asked about size. Probably a little between 4 and 5 feet.
Oh,
and yeah, big around as maybe a tennis ball. I mean, he was doing well.
Wow.
He was eating well. He was a high earner, as they say.
Well, look, you're the second person who's mentioned that you went over the Roan Mountain Balls, which are spectacular, aren't they, in 50-mile-an-hour gusts. What was that like, with that experience like? Did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it. It's one of those odd moments in life where it's simultaneously stunningly beautiful. Just an absolute vision. I mean, just something that you can't describe it to other people. And it's the grassy, you know, it's almost like, you know, the grassy plains, but they're so steep and never ending, these gigantic balls.
Yeah.
And the trail, you know, the actual footpath is, what would you say, 15, 17 inches wide?
Oh, yeah.
And 6 inches deep.
Yeah. Dangerous to walk in sometimes.
So you're, you're doing a tightrope walk, which is difficult enough, but then these 50 mile an hour gusts, they literally blew me over on my side a half dozen times. And I'm not exaggerating, not exaggerating a bit. And I was all alone. You know, I've been walking pretty much solo since week two, and there wasn't anybody in front of me or behind me. So I just took my time and just kind of trudged up it. But, you know, I was doing some bargaining, you know, with the Almighty or Mother Nature or whatever you want to call it. I was like, you know, just stop it with the wind or stop it with the false summits, you know, pick
one.
It
doesn't work like that.
You're trying to make me quit, you know, like make the wind stop or I'm going to stop, you know, but I mean, it was, you know, eye-watering wind. I mean, it's just really, I hadn't experienced anything like it that wasn't like, you know, at the ocean or something. But
it's an epic place. So to have that in wind must be, I think that would be extra epic in many ways. And in terms of you mentioned that you're hiking alone a lot. Has anybody named you yet, or have you named yourself? I can't recall whether we had a trail name for you.
Yeah, my trail name is Red, and I kind of picked that.
Fine.
It's been a nickname of mine from some of my friends, and a guy that I was hiking with in the early days, he sadly had to come off trail. He just had some debilitating back issues. He kind of formally, you know, named me that, but that's kind of the name I've chosen. You know, my name's Ron, but Red's just as good. And,
So why are you hiking by yourself? Is that a choice, or, I mean, you obviously meet up the same people every now and then, or are you just happy to be by, you enjoying that solitude?
I am enjoying it. In fact, I was talking to somebody yesterday about that very thing. And if you had told me a year ago, you know, that I was going to be out here on the Appalachian Trail and walking most of the miles daily and all of the hours and all of the miles daily by myself, I would have told you you're crazy, because the whole reason I want to be out here is, you know, to be part of that community and experience that togetherness and shared struggle that. And that's still true, but I don't know. It's hard for me to answer. I will say this. I think part of it is, you know, a little bit of social distancing in order to avoid, you know, norovirus. You know, any other kind of, you know, sickness or whatever. I think, you know, maybe subconsciously that's kind of a holdover from, you know, our time in COVID and all that kind of stuff. But really, the number one driver in that is hike your own hike. I set my own schedule. I determine where I'm going to go every day, and that may or may not change. You know, that may or may not, if I choose a certain milepost to be at tomorrow, I may go further, or I may stop shorter, or I may choose to go to see this particular vista or blue blaze, or I might not. If I'm walking with other people, which I have done, there's a lot more compromise. When you break, you know, and I don't want to hold anybody up.
But Ron, it develops, you know, this will develop, you know, you'll hike with somebody for a day or a week or 5 minutes or whatever it's going to be. And if you like each other's style, you get on with each other, you might find one will want to stay with you. Damascus has got the cops going on now.
Yeah, they're after me. Now, hang on a second. Here comes the rescue squad.
All right.
Anyway, they're gone.
Okay, right. So you work it out. You know, you're working it out as it is anyway. And you're now hiking your own hike. There will come a time, I suspect, where you'll think, "Oh, crikey, I could do with a bit more company." And it may well be that you drift into somebody who feels just the same. It may well be that you don't. And that's okay as well. You know, you have to make your hike the way you want it. If you get to that stage where you think to yourself, "Oh, I really need some company here," you'll probably start speaking with people at shelters, and you'll find out people have the same feelings sometimes. So don't worry. No, I know you're not worried about that, but just let it happen, because it will happen almost organically.
Yeah, and that's so true. One of the things I've come to learn is just by simply stopping and greeting someone on the trail. You know, if you're north going and they're south going, or I overtake someone, or I'm overtaken, which is mostly the case. You know, I'll ask, you know, how are you? You know, where are you from? If sure. I don't know them.
Sure.
Or I know we met at such and such. Tell me your trail name again. And that's always fun because, you know, I was in the Outfitter earlier and I ran into somebody I hadn't seen since Hot Springs.
Yeah.
And we had a chat and, you know, they were like, man, I thought you'd be miles ahead. And I'm like, well, you know, I've been taking it easy. You know, I go fast on trails some days, but then other times I'll decide to take time off. I'm just fortunate. I'm lucky and I'm blessed that I'm healthy. I feel good physically, you know, mentally I'm good. So
you've got to be grateful for that health. It's the keeping your health and keeping fit and just enjoying the hike is important. But I know you've had a couple of lows as well, both of which involve being in shelters. So talk to us about the Bald Mountain shelter and the Rhone High Mountain shelter.
Bald Mountain was a 20-mile day for me. It was one of the first, and it was in a week where I had done a couple of others.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of felt like, oh, okay, you know, I can do this. Bald Mountain has some elevation to it, and the weather deteriorated pretty significantly throughout the afternoon. So the second half of the climb, which is where all the elevation is for that section that I was tackling, came in the rain. So to cut to the chase, I got to Bald Mountain shelter at long last. It is, if anybody knows specifically where I'm talking about it, it is down this long meandering trail, well past Bald Mountain, the actual Bald. And I finally arrived there, and the shelter is packed. There's no room in the inn, and it is buckets of rain coming down. So I just pulled up my pants and said, "All right, let's find us a spot." And I pitched my tent in the pouring rain, and there was a ton of water beneath the tent floor pan and you know, the bathtub and the ground cover. Thank goodness I had a ground cover, but you know, I stayed dry and warm, and I did all my cooking in the vestibule, which I hadn't done before, and you know, you got to be careful doing that, and I got my bear canister stowed away, and you know, I woke up the next morning, still raining, put my tent up, wet, and hiked on.
Happy days, eh?
yeah.
And you had a cold night in Rhone High shelter. You said it was overnight 37 degrees. That's not that bad, is it? Oh, that was inside the shelter. It's enclosed as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, with a door and everything. Yeah,
right.
It 37 degrees is pretty chilly. But again, it was snowed overnight, which was kind of neat. I really wanted to stay in the highest elevation shelter on the AT. I didn't want to just walk past it.
Right.
And I couldn't have, cause I didn't get there until 5 o'clock.
Right.
It was, the weather was getting worse, but I had plenty of room in the shelter. Although we were a packed house that night, I think it helped, you know, body heat kind of generates, That ended up being okay. It's just, I was just talking with another guy who just walked past the porch I'm sitting on right now, but he was in that shelter with me. We were laughing about it. I think I was in my sleeping bag, Steve, for 14 hours.
Oh, gosh. And that is a long time, isn't it? That is a heck of a long time. I know you know, because there's nothing else to do, is there really? You know, you might as well get in your bag and make sure you're warm and dry.
Yeah, you can't get warm outside of your bag. So I was, you know, had all my clothes on, my gloves, and I was all, you know, hunky-dory in there. And then I think I popped out at some point, you know, in the middle of the night to go outside to, you know, whatever. But, awesome. But it could have been a lot worse. It could have been a little bit warmer and raining. Oh, I'll take the snow.
That's funny. Well, look, I'm so glad you're embracing everything to do with the trail. You know, I think you're likely to find somebody to hike with at some stage who just has that commonality of interest. So, you know, just keep enjoying it. And maybe I'll see you at trail. If you are coming back, I'll see you at Trail Days. And I look forward to seeing you. Okay. And perhaps we'll talk. I'll record you then as well.
I will absolutely be there. My darling wife is going to join me here. Cool. So she and I are going to come to the author's tent. We'll find you.
I tell you what, in that case, we'll have a beer sometime there and I'll interview her. I'll interview her as well, I think, about what it's like and so on. If she's up for that, yeah.
I'm not going to tell her about it. So, you know, the chances of her actually doing it will be greatly increased if you just spring it on her.
Okay. All right, then, man. Well, good to talk to you.
Looking forward to seeing you.
Good. And you too. So, yes, stop by and say hi, and we'll perhaps I'll try to get away and we'll have a drink, okay?
Yeah, man.
Cheers, man. All the best. Bye.
Bye.
I must say, talking with our class members when they're right in the middle of it really enhances my memory of doing it myself. Talking with Ron just then, as he made his way over those awesome boards, took me right back there to that narrow, really difficult path. I'd kind of forgotten about it, but it all came out. As most of you know, because I mentioned it last week, I'm heading out onto the AT after Trail Days this week, so I wonder how many memories will be coming back to me of places I've just forgotten. Obviously, I'll tell you all about it when I return. Now, if you recall, Steve Korderkamp was about to head out with his daughter Brooke last time we spoke. Let's hear what happened.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
Better than you by the sound of things. This is the call nobody wants to make, and I reached out to you the other day. We're on with Steve Korderkamp, and you're back home. So what happened?
The second day in, well, the first day I started back with my PVCs and really felt lousy the second day. Couldn't eat, couldn't drink. So
how did they manifest themselves then, Steve?
Really just started right when we got to the steps, halfway up the steps. So at the beginnings, and I just made a decision that probably not wise to continue until I get this thing figured out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was already dehydrated the second day, couldn't drink anything, couldn't eat. So I made the call of the wife to come pick me up.
Right. That must have been a tough call. And what about your daughter then? Is Brooke carrying on?
Yes. Yep. She's in the Smokies right now. Just spent a couple of days in Gatlinburg, and
yeah,
she's having some trouble with some plantar fasciitis. So.
This ain't easy, is it? This, you know, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it anyway. And also luck plays a massive part in it as well. So you're back home now. Have you seen your doctor again?
No, not yet. No, I've got an appointment. We'll go and see him, but we'll figure out what's going on.
Yeah. When did you actually come off the trail? You said day two. How long ago was that?
That was like April 11th.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of wondered why I hadn't heard from you, and you know, I kind of guess we are going to follow Brooke. So what happens now? You know, assuming let's take the positive route that the guy works out what the issue was and says, yeah, that's okay, we can sort that out, and you're good to go. Will you go again?
Probably next year. This year is off for sure.
Right. Yeah.
I might join Brooke for a day hike with slack packing or something, but my job's kind of changed from hiking. Now I'm just in a support mode, so we're helping her out as much as we can.
But you know what? That's gonna be a pretty valuable thing anyway, isn't it? You know, and I'm sure you'll get a lot of vicarious pleasure from that as well. We're going to actually speak to her, obviously, hopefully in a couple of weeks' time. What's her experience so far? How is she enjoying it?
Oh, she's having a great time. She met a girl from Great Britain, a nurse that she's been hanging around with. Her name's Sarah. They've been hiking together for, I guess, a couple of weeks now.
Right.
That kind of helps me worrying about her, you know, that she's with somebody.
Only a little bit, I'm sure. Yeah. So you didn't enjoy it right from the beginning then. So those it's difficult really to get any impression from you then in terms of how it was. Did you actually get to the top?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. we made it up the Springer Mountain. And that's when I called it the Springer Mountain parking lot.
Right, right.
That's when I got a shuttle down. And we actually waited a day in, I can't remember the name of the town. But
Dahlonega?
No, it wasn't Dahlonega. Right. It was Blairsville. Okay. We went to Blairsville.
Right.
And spent a day. Then that's when I called my wife because it wasn't getting any better.
Right.
And even when I got into town, I still couldn't eat anything. I was just had no appetite. It was just getting weaker by the day. So.
And since you've returned home, what's happened? Are you feeling better now? Or you sound pretty down, I got to tell you. So are you just not feeling physically well at the moment?
I'm feeling better. It's just depressing because I've been waiting so long to do it.
And, yeah.
You know, it's just something I thought about, watched videos and read multiple books and just thought about it for years. And
you know, it ain't going away. It ain't going away, is it? So, you know, it's going to be there. And I'm sure if you get the chance to do it again, it'll be more than, you know, even even richer experience because of what you've experienced so far. You know, disappointment is part of it. I mean, it's kind of one of those things. And at least you made the call, which was a sensible call, because a lot of people don't make that call. And they could end up in all sorts of trouble if they don't make that call. So, where did you spend the first night? Did you sleep in your tent at all?
We spent the first night. Really, what we did was we did the stairs the first day.
Sure.
Because my wife was dropping us off, so we hiked the stairs, went up and stayed at the lodge, which is where my wife was staying.
Right.
And the next day, it rained for 24 hours straight. we made the call that we checked with the hotel, with the lodge, and they had a room, so we just stayed there for the whole day. And the next day we went up, the following day, that was Easter Sunday when we started. Mm-hmm. And we went on the registry at Springer Mountain. Only five people had registered on that rainy day.
So,
it was just not a good day to start, so we decided, we're here, we might as well just wait it out. And It would have been miserable. It literally rained all day long.
Yeah. So do you have the conversation with your daughter? Did she consider coming home with you, or did you encourage her to go on?
I encouraged her to go on, and she wanted to go on too. Good. And that was our agreement before, that if one of us dropped out, the other one would continue.
Right. And has she got a trail name yet?
It started off with Turtle, but there was too many turtles. So now they call it Crush.
What they call it?
Crush.
Crush. Oh, nice. That's
the name of a turtle in, I can't remember, one of the Disney movies.
Cool. Very cool.
Well, I think Finding Nemo, that's what it's from.
Oh, right. I see. Got to get the technical details right. Well, disappointing, I know. And, man, it sucks. Of course it sucks. I just hope that you feel that the effort is still going to be worthwhile and you want to come back and get it done at some stage. And that, well, the most important thing of all, of course, is that you get yourself better. Once you've done that, then you can think about other things. But at the moment, you've obviously done the right thing, and we're going to follow Brooke. And perhaps I might, you know, if you're going to go and join her, perhaps we can talk to you obviously on the trail as well, which would be really cool, you know, later in the year.
That sounds good.
Okay, man. Well, look, keep your chin up. You know, there's no point in getting down about it because it sucks. Of course it sucks. And, you know, you should get back there. All right?
Right.
Okay, man. Well, I appreciate you. Appreciate you talking to me anyway. Okay?
All right.
Cheers then.
Thanks, Steve.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm afraid there's just no accounting for that. Your health, of course, takes priority over pretty much everything. But you could hear desperate disappointment in Steve's voice. We'd spoken before offline, and his enthusiasm to do the trial was so apparent. Having to leave it at the start is galling, but with a bit of luck, his doc should be able to resolve it to allow him to try again next year. In the meantime, I'm going to follow Brooke going forward, so we'll hear her first catch-up in 2 weeks' time. Thanks, as ever, go to our donors who keep this show on the air. This week, monthly donors Gail Posey, Sabre Thompson, Todd Withrow, Ron Ward and Suzanne Johnson have continued to show their love. If you'd like to join them, you can head to hikingradionetwork.com and click on one of the ubiquitous donate buttons that you're going to find everywhere. Thanks. So, with Steve back home, we know that Mark Carpenter is still heading north. Here's Mark.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Doing great.
Long time no speak. You are. I can't actually remember when we last spoke, but it's been some time.
I was at the Nantahala.
Are you at the outdoor center? Wow. So, what mile are you up now then?
798.
You are skating along.
It doesn't feel like it. But, yeah, I'm getting there.
So what does it feel like? So let me, before you tell me that, 798, I remember the 800-mile mark. Obviously, it's a different mileage then. So I'm trying to think where you are. So you've actually just done McAfee Knob and Tinker Cliffs and Dragon's Tooth. Talk to us about that, the Virginia Triple Crown.
Well, Dragon Tooth, incredibly hard. Especially because I was... I don't know if it's a shin splint or what. My right shin has been bothering me, and that was very challenging for me.
Right. But, did you climb up it? Because the approach to Dragon's Tooth itself, I found quite difficult generally. But then I found the climb up okay. Did you actually climb up it as well?
I did not, because I started to, and I thought I might risk falling because my right leg was.
It's an it's an amazing spot though, isn't it? And I don't think. And I certainly wasn't ready for the coming down the other side of it. Because if you were struggling with your shin, then I suspect that was a tough climb down for you.
It was. It was a lot of ouch, ooh, ah, a lot of that going on.
Old man's noises. Old man's noises. We call
exactly,
those.
Yeah. There was a guy that I had met in the Smokies, and he had got off trail. I haven't seen him since then, but he had sent me a text, asked where I was, and I was approaching Dragon's Tooth, and he said, "Hey, put away your trekking poles."
Definitely.
So I knew what I was going to need both hands free coming down. Yeah,
it's quite an experience, though, isn't it? You know, I know there's the aching and moaning and so on, but really, it's quite the experience. And then, of course, that sets you up for McAfee Knob several miles later. What time of day did you go up to McAfee Knob?
I was around 3 o'clock, 3:30. It was gorgeous, though. It was a great day. That I was so excited to go there because it's such an iconic and place, and it did not disappoint.
No, it never does. Yeah. But then for me, one of the completely unsung gems is Tinker Cliffs soon after, which was magnificent, isn't it?
Yes. I spent a little time there as well, just hanging out. I wish I could have camped. I was starting to set up my tent, and I said, well, let me double check.
Yeah.
And I guess camping's not permitted. So
not a good thing. And you say in your note to me that you've been hiking by yourself since May the 7th because your hiking partner got off trail in Perrysburg. What happened?
He had been contemplating it for a while, and he didn't have the same passion or the dream that I personally had. And I think he checked with his family and he decided to go home. So he was done.
And have you heard from him since?
Oh, yeah. We text almost every day, and trying to entice him to come back. So.
You know what, though? When you're done, aren't you? Really? I mean, it's understandable. And then you said that three other hikers you've met and befriended also recently got off trail. Coach Feisty and the Almighty must have been one. Why is that? Are they people getting tired, or is the weather getting tough, or what?
Well, I saw, just by chance, I ran into Coach at the Middle Creek campground, and she had taken a bad fall coming down McAfee Knob, and she said that she had taken a few zeros and trying to feel better, and she just said, I'm done. So her husband was coming to get her that same day that I saw her, and then Feisty and Almighty is a couple from Minnesota, and I had caught up with them and talked to them, and they were contemplating going home. They were missing the grandkids and things, and they took a zero day in Salem, Virginia. And I sent them a text to say, "Hey, where are you?" And they They said they just had a disaster. They lost all their IDs, and it was just a bad moment. And I think that was certainly just put them over the edge, and they just went home.
So you've been hiking with people, but then you've been hiking by yourself now for, well, we're recording on May the 16th. You've been hiking by yourself for over a week. How different is it to be by yourself?
Extremely different, extremely. You know, when I was hiking with my hiking partner, Moving On, we would talk and we would laugh and we would joke and we would just enjoy the same views. And now that I'm by myself, I talk to myself a lot, I guess.
There's good and bad about that, of course.
Oh, I know, right? It's not the same. And I haven't found anyone yet that has the same kind of pace or the same kind of start time.
Don't you think it's fascinating, though, that you have to adapt to what the trail gives you anyway, don't you? You can't make you can't make stuff happen. It just, you know, you'll get the opportunity to do something and you'll do it, and you may find yourself in some sort of a good relationship with somebody and get on well with somebody, and then you'll start hiking together. But you can't force it, can you? It just has to happen. Yeah. You sound a bit sad about that, by the way.
Yeah. I'm a little, I was a little disappointed. It was just luck that I met the hiking partner like day two, and then we hiked since day three, which was over 600 miles, and we got along so well. And now I just haven't found, not that I'm, like you said, it's got to happen organically.
Yeah.
Can't force it, but that hasn't happened for a week or so. So it's very different.
Yes. Oh, it is different. No question. But you're going to find it changes again before the end. I can guarantee you. You know, it's not going to be the same. You know, it never is. And one thing you said, Virginia is not flat, as you said. All of the trail is hard.
You were right on. You're spot on. It is all hard. And I've talked to a couple people, and I said, "Oh, you know, we get this big uphill tomorrow, but the next day looks easy." And I said, "No. It's all hard. Because if it looks flat, it's probably got a lot of rocks and roots on it.
Yeah.
So it's not easy."
So how is the physicality, you know, how are you treating the physicality? Are you losing weight? Are you eating enough food? I mean, what is it? I mean, how much weight have you dropped?
I think I've lost nearly 20 pounds. I try to eat a decent breakfast. I don't eat a good lunch. I should take more time for that. Mm-hmm. And I eat a pretty good dinner. But I know when I was running low on food near the Triple Crown, I really felt it.
Wow.
Starting to realize I was getting a little weaker.
Yeah.
And then on the physical side, it's been like my feet or ankles, and now my right shin. I cut back a couple of days on the miles, and I did feel a little better.
Right.
But then when I started going again, you know, it started hurting again. So I'll get through it. It's just got to manage it.
It's I don't think people realize quite how much energy you burn. And if you don't eat sufficient food, you are going to burn your reserves as well, aren't you? And you need to be very careful with that, because you cannot afford to be weak, especially the further north you go, it gets tougher and tougher. So, you know, none of this is easy. And you mentioned that one of your hardest day was crossing over Roan Mountain, Jane Bald, Little Hump Mountain, which is one of my favorite parts of the trail. So you must have gone over that day when it was incredibly windy, did you?
It was a little bit windy, but it was just challenging because there's so much uphill and downhill, and it was around a 15 mile day because we camped short of Roan Mountain because it was going to be frosting up there.
Sure.
And once we cleared Hump Mountain, you still got that downhill, which is lots of rocks.
Yes.
And it's just it was not an easy day.
And the path itself is not easy there, is it? The path itself is quite rocky, and it's quite narrow as well. So you've got to stay on the path as well. But you said that your son, one of your sons, is joining you on May the 24th, so that's a week's time for 5 or 6 days. Is he prepared for this? Is he physically prepared for this?
He's pretty much in shape. I don't know about hiking shape, but he is physically active, and he works out a lot. So It's going to be an interesting experience. He lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, so it's real close to where I'm going to be. So
nice. And the last thing you put in the text was you're always tinkering with your gear. So what have you changed so far then?
Well, I upgraded my kitchen. I went and got the Jetboil.
Oh, did you?
And nice. So that's been great. Yeah. And then I was actually looking for a chair. Mm-hmm. I know you had mentioned that before.
Love it.
I realized, boy, I would like to have a chair.
Yes.
Yeah. So actually, I was out looking today, and I couldn't find the 1 pound chair. I'm still going to look. Maybe when I get to Waynesboro, I can find one there. And then also, I did switch to an Ursac.
All right.
And it's worked out fine. But the word I get from some of the outfitters is that, you know, for the future, the AT is going to, insist on these bear cans because there has been a lot of bear activity.
Have you seen many bears?
I have not seen any, but there was Matt's Creek, which I hiked through yesterday.
Remember it well.
They had closed that shelter.
Oh, really?
Because of bear activity.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then when I came across the James River, I ran into a hiker who just said he spoke to a ranger who was escorting two campers, two hikers to the camp, to the parking lot, that they had a bear circling their tent last night.
Oh, so, not that at all.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
it was another reason for me to take a zero day.
Well, look, I'm glad you're having fun. I'm glad you're enjoying it. And do not resist the urge to get the 1 pound chair. It is life altering on the trail. It is so much nicer to have than not have, I tell you. So just carry on. And we'll speak. I'm actually going to be hiking myself on the AT after trail days. So I'm going to be away next week, but we'll catch up again in the next 2 or 3 weeks. Okay.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Okay, man. Well, good talk to you. Okay.
All right. Take care.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
Mark's such a happy warrior and so imbued into the culture of the trail that while he's still loving it, he misses having a hiking partner. Personally, I always intended to go alone on my two through hikes, yet your people find you. Lydenot and Trigger in 2014 and 2019 respectively, I didn't meet until I was many miles into the trail. I think Mark, even if you may not feel it right now, is getting the best of both worlds. You can't force it. It'll happen when and if it happens. Yet he's having the privilege of trying out those two very different hikes, with and without a partner. As I said, things will change. You just never know when. Now, just a bit of housekeeping before we move on to Then the Hail Came. I'm off to trail days on Thursday, then hiking most of next week back to Damascus. So instead of leaving you high and dry without an episode next Thursday, I've already posted one. Obviously can't include 2023 class updates, so I asked you all for a middle section segment, and unfortunately, I didn't have time to incorporate your ideas into the show, though I did make some notes for the future. So, next week's show will be the main interview, which is another really good one, by the way, followed by the next part of Then the Hail Came. It's still going to run for about an hour, so I hope you're able to get your AT fix before we resume normal operations the week after. Got it? Great. As I mentioned earlier, the last minute or so of Then the Hail Came was cut off last week. So this week, I'm putting that minute back in, then following straight on to this week's section of the book. I'll see you, hopefully, at Trail Days. Then you'll hear me next week. The Appalachian Trail descended steeply down the cliffs which constitute the northern face of Bear Mountain into a deep, narrow, densely wooded ravine. As I entered Sage's Ravine, I crossed the Massachusetts border. 10 states down and 4 to go. A wide, roaring brook, teeming with cascades, small waterfalls and deep, quiet pools, knifed a deep cleft through the ridge. In many sections, steep cliffs towered over the banks of the brook. Smaller streams cascaded down their rocky faces to join the brook on its dash down the mountain. Mature forest, dominated by conifers, covered the slope. I sat down by the south bank of the brook to take my third long break in less than 7 miles of desultory hiking, once again guzzling large quantities of cold water to relieve my arid mouth. I was paying the price for my night of debauchery. I didn't care. It had been worth it. Connecticut replenished my waning excitement for the trail. The beautiful views and the lovely forests were a tantalizing indication of what is to come. In this state, for once, I was extremely lucky with the weather. The cool, sunny days with very low humidity were a welcome surprise in the middle of August. Even that one cool, rainy day hiking north out of Kent was a nice change of pace from the steam bath atmosphere through which I've been hiking since southern Virginia. The best part of all of this is that I know it only gets better. While I've previously hiked but one stretch of the Appalachian Trail in northern New England, I've spent enough time in those states to know that each one is a little more spectacular scenically than the last. At the end of the trail lies Maine, where all good backpackers go when they die. Chapter 18, Night of a Thousand Screams. Sages Ravine, Massachusetts to North Adams, Massachusetts. Monday, the 15th of August, 1983. Continued. From Sages Ravine, the Appalachian Trail climbed steeply to another wooded plateau. In the middle of a cool, dark hemlock forest, it crossed Bear Rock Stream near the eastern rim of the plateau. I took a short side trip to one of my favourite places on earth, following the stream east off the trail for about 50 yards, where the flat ground ends with an abrupt stroke of a giant axe and high cliff towers above the broad, bucolic upper Housatonic Valley. The southern tip of the Berkshires seems to spring just as suddenly from the flattish valley floor a few miles away on the eastern edge. A few feet behind me, the stream plunged over the edge of the plateau, the beginning of a tall series of cascades. I took another 15-minute break there. Were I to pick a stretch of trail to be hiking over while shaking off the effects of a bad hangover, the Taconic section of the Appalachian Trail would be one of my top choices. There was plenty of water, despite the long, dry summer, and plenty of nice places at which to take my frequent rest stops. Tastes of northern New England abound. The broad swathe of subalpine scrub running from the summit down the southwestern slopes of Bear Mountain in Connecticut, the cold rushing waters and hushed evergreen forests of Sages Ravine. This spot, more to come. From Bear Rock Stream, the next mile and a half of the Appalachian Trail ascended Race Mountain, picking its way up a boulder-strewn slope softened by a carpet of fallen needles from the hemlock. The last half mile threaded a narrow perch atop massive naked rock cliffs and crossed another rocky, scrubby summit area. Hawks drifted lazily on the smooth thermals of a mid-August afternoon, soaring high above the valley below. A long, steep descent into a sag was followed by a longer, steeper climb up Mount Everett, the highest peak in the Taconics at 2,602 feet. The fire tower, which is closed to the public, wink wink, gave sprawling 360-degree views over miles of mountains, hills, lakes and valleys. Although it was warmer and more humid than recent days, the visibility was mostly unobstructed. The Appalachian Trail descended from the summit to a state picnic area near Gilder Pond. The wind-rippled surface of the second-highest pond in Massachusetts lies 2,042 feet above sea level, a greater altitude than on any mountaintop the AT had climbed since Virginia. Pete and I obtained water at a stream crossing just past the picnic area and walked on a little further to a flat piece of ground on the southern slopes of Mount Undine, where we set up camp for the night. I could have gone on a bit further, but that climb up Mount Everett had done me in, and 12.5 miles over terrain like this was enough of an accomplishment for a day during which I was nursing the Godzilla of hangovers. The heat and humidity made a partial comeback today. Nevertheless, it was still a wonderful day, easily the best day scenically since the long-ago July day when I traversed the northern portion of Shenandoah. Tuesday the 16th of August 1983, mile 1501. As you can see, I passed the 1,500-mile point today. Is it just my imagination, or is that a lot of freaking miles to walk carrying a backpack? I often dream of tossing this damn thing off a high cliff when this journey is over, particularly on those recent 100-degree days when it was plastered to my back by a raging Niagara of sweat. Today began with the final 3.5 miles of the eastern fork of the Taconic Range, Mount Bushnell with its excellent views, Jug End with more extensive views, and a series of nice lookouts in between. Jug End in particular was outstanding. Just as Lion's Head stands sentinel over the southern flank of the ridge, Jug End is its northern outpost. Near its summit, the ridge crest abruptly ends, the ground plunging steeply toward the valley on both the north and east flanks, providing northward vistas unsurpassed on the range. I could see for miles up the Housatonic Valley to the north, the line of the Berkshires to the northeast, and the western fork of the Taconics to the northwest. The trail down Jug End had just been relocated. Gone was the killer descent I remembered from my previous trips. The new trail seemed almost an order of magnitude better than the old. In no time, I was on the dirt surface to Jug End Road, beginning the 5.5-mile Housatonic Valley Roadwalk, crossing over from the Taconics to the Berkshires. An excellent little piped spring was located just a quarter mile into the roadwalk, an opportunity to chug water and fill my canteen. Today was considerably hotter and more humid than yesterday. This return to the dog days of August was almost inevitable. Sticky and sweltering is the official weather of a Jules Stephanus roadwalk. I'd lucked out on that last big New York roadwalk, but conditions were back to normal for this one. The Appalachian Trail followed dirt roads for most of the ensuing 5 miles to US 7, but the final mile or so was on a paved road. I passed through an attractive mixture of farms and woods, green and gold fields of ripening corn, cool, dark forest groves, green pastures dappled with yellow dandelions, some amazing views back towards the Taconics, and one feature I could have done without. I'm beginning to grow tired of the aroma of frying cow pies. I encountered nothing today comparable to that 3-mile-long trail of steaming manure on the long roadwalk in New Jersey, but the occasional dairy farms I passed made their presence known. At Route 7, I made a side trip off the AT to check out another fruit stand, which my philosopher's guide informed me was about a mile up the road. The stand was less than a half mile from the trail. Like the fruit stand I visited in New Jersey, the place was a lot more than I expected. They had a grill sizzling with hamburgers and hot dogs, and they also carried cold soda, ice cream, and even home-baked bread and pies. As usual, I was nearly out of crackers, bread, Pop-Tarts, and just about anything else I could chew. Thus, the home-baked bread was the nicest surprise. I thought that I would have to suffer bravely like a little soldier for a while. Sob, sniff. I enjoyed a dainty little snack of 2 cheeseburgers smothered in grilled onions, 2 Cokes, and a pint of chocolate ice cream. If I'm not mistaken, I think that is the meal which doctors prescribe for heart patients. I also bought a loaf of fresh-baked wheat bread for the trail. I'm watching my cholesterol. I could hardly wait to tear into it. I wish that I had tried a bite then. I would have bought 2. Back on the Appalachian Trail, I crossed the Housatonic River about halfway through the final half mile of the roadwalk. The most unique feature of the Housatonic Valley roadwalk had been the flatness of the terrain. The entire 5.5 miles were virtually all on level ground. I can think of no other stretch of the Appalachian Trail which comes close to this. Most valley crossings are mainly descent and ascent, with a small strip of level ground in the middle. A recent relocation had cut off a quarter mile from the end of the roadwalk, while eliminating an infamous patch of poison ivy. The relocation was not a very good trail. It was steep and rocky, but it was not terrible, so I guess it was an improvement. I cannot say for sure, never having seen the old trail. When I came down off Jug End, I had completed the second of the 3 sections of the Appalachian Trail, which I had hiked prior to this trip. I'm in virgin territory once again, until the White Mountains of New Hampshire. The AT climbed over June Mountain, crossed a paved road on the other side, and re-entered the forest. I took a break in a cool grove of pines, just beyond the road crossing. It was a sweltering day. After all, it is still August, and conditions were taking their toll. Another new trail relocation climbed East Mountain. You must always be ready for the unexpected on the AT. I had the brand new 1983 Massachusetts Connecticut guidebook, and it didn't even hint that relocations were being considered for the trail on June and East Mountains. Judging by the description of the old trail in the guidebook, the second relocation was a big improvement over the old trail. When the relo ended and I rejoined the old trail, an exhausting climb led straight up some smooth rock faces. From the ledges at the top, there were nice views westward across the Housatonic Valley to the Taconics. This helped make up for the fact that I was as drenched from my own sweat as I would have been had I walked into a shower fully clothed. The trail descended off the ridge. I passed 2 springs, but both were dry. I needed water badly. The Appalachian Trail followed a narrow, rocky spur that gradually split off from the main crest, becoming separated from it by a steep, narrow ravine. When the spur eventually petered out, the trail plunged into the ravine and scrambled steeply back up to the main ridge. I didn't see the point of this exercise. There were no views along that rocky spur, and that ravine was difficult to negotiate with a heavy backpack. But, God knows, I never questioned the way the trail is laid out. The trail again gradually descended off the ridge, then climbed back up. That set the pattern for the next few miles. Up, down, up, down. I crossed several brooks, all dry. After 5 miles, I came to the next roadwalk. This one was little more than a mile in length, and I was able to get my water bottle filled by some nice kids playing in a schoolyard. It appeared to be a school for special children, and the adults glared protectively at me as if I were Aqualung or something. But the water was cold and good. I drank half of it on the spot before I began the ensuing climb. There were many short, steep pitches, but this section of the trail was not as bad as the previous one had been. I was soon at Benedict Pond, a pleasant body of water high up in the Berkshires. It was the second high mountain lake I had passed in Massachusetts in as many days. The guidebook shows several more on the trail up ahead, so I guess that these tarns are a signature feature of the Appalachian Trail in this state. After the pond was a steep but very short climb up to the ledges, which I didn't find all that exciting or ledge-like. I found the more storied Berkshires a slight disappointment at first after the spectacle of the Taconics, and I suspect the return of the dog days had a great deal to do with this. Next came an extremely sharp descent into a narrow valley, crossing two more dry brooks. I'm going to remember the drought of 83 for a long time. After one final short steep climb, I came to the spring, which is the water supply for the Mount Wilcox South Shelter. It was running, barely. It took a long time to fill my water bag, catching the trickle of water in my cup. When this was accomplished, I finished climbing the last steep slope to the shelter's side trail. Two couples from England were standing at the trail junction, staring at a sign which read Shelter, above an arrow pointing down the side trail. The structure was out of sight from the junction, around the side of the mountain. I knew from my guidebook that the shelter capacity was 6 and that Pete was already there. I was a little depressed about the prospect of being crammed inside a full shelter on what was shaping up to be a very warm night. The British couples, unfamiliar with the Appalachian Trail shelter system, thought the sign was pointing to an enormous rock just up the side trail. I may have forgotten to correct that misconception. I told them about a flat, grassy, abandoned woods road which I had crossed just before reaching the spring. It was an excellent campsite, and short-term campers prefer the tenting experience anyway. Well, they do. I arrived at the shelter a few minutes later. I had been planning to stay at Mount Wilcox North Shelter, a couple of miles further up the AT, but I had been told that the structure was falling apart and that its brook was dry. This shelter was in nice condition for this part of the AT, so I laid out my gear and made dinner. The shelter register warned about a porcupine who has adopted the place, so I hung up my boots as well as my food. Porkies are reported to love the taste of leather. I really didn't need a porcupine to show up here tonight and keep me awake. 20 miles was no picnic in today's heat. Wednesday the 17th of August 1983, mile 1517.3. That porcupine did show up, waking me about 20 times by gnawing on the outside of the shelter. Obviously the wood was tastier than it looked, and no doubt was packed with fibre. I tried to frighten him off a few times by shining my flashlight in his face, but he just turned his back on me and raised his quills as if to say, "Make me leave." I had my worst night of sleep on the entire trail. It was past 8 o'clock when I set my bleary eyes on the trail this morning, beginning the remainder of the climb up Mount Wilcox. There were no views from the ground around the summit, and the fire tower possessed an imposing fence topped with barbed wire. I passed on it. I saw some attractive forests on the slopes of the mountain, particularly as I descended the north side. Forests of lofty hardwoods predominated, carpeted by lush fern growth. Along the way, I passed the Mount Wilcox North Shelter. It was a pit, as advertised, and the brook was dry, so I guess that my night with Porky had been the best of two bad alternatives. Just past the shelter was a long, pleasant stroll through a plantation of tall spruce trees. The more restrained charms of the Berkshires were beginning to win me over as well. Shortly after the spruce, the 7-mile Tyringham Valley road walk began. The first couple of miles were on a rough dirt road, mostly through woods. Then the Appalachian Trail followed paved roads past large estates posted with a profusion of no trespassing signs, reminiscent of Northern Virginia. The road walk was nothing like the flat Housatonic Valley. The roads descended steadily and often steeply into the village of Tyringham. When I reached the downtown area, it turned out to be a post office, a payphone, and a few houses. I called home from the payphone to set up my supply drop for Friday and headed right out. From Tyringham, the Appalachian Trail climbed out of the valley, still following roads. There was one particularly steep stretch through a badly gullied jeep road. I skirted Lower Goose Pond, just visible through a screen of trees and no trespassing signs, and continued uphill. The AT finally turned off the roads and passed through forests of pine, hemlock and hardwoods on its way to Upper Goose Pond. Once again, the forest floor was a mass of brilliant green ferns. That is becoming one of my favourite features of the Berkshires. The National Park Service recently bought up a great deal of land around Upper Goose Pond for the permanent Appalachian Trail corridor, and a relocation had been made which lengthened the hike down to the pond, but seemed to be much safer than the old trail described in the guidebook. The spring at the state-run campsite near the east shore of the pond was barely running, but at least it was running. I'd run out of water again. Another relocation just past the campsite added an additional mile to the AT, but it was also another good relo. The old trail had quickly departed from the pond, while this one followed its shoreline for a half mile. The climb away from the pond also seemed like a big improvement over the description of the old trail. Soon after Upper Goose Pond, I crossed the concrete Appalachian Trail footbridges over the Massachusetts Turnpike. I had driven beneath them many times, always swearing that one day I would walk across them on an AT through hike. This would have probably been a very exciting and emotional moment for me, except that, for some reason, it wasn't. I arrived at the AT crossing of US 20 shortly thereafter and turned left down that road toward the half mile to a tavern, which my guidebook told me served meals. As I strode down that road beneath the broiling sun, I was daydreaming about large cold cokes and larger meals. I was psyched. When I got there, the place was closed. That was an emotional moment. Muttering a few colourful phrases, I turned around to complete a useless 1 mile round trip off the AT. Having passed a motor lodge directly adjacent to the Appalachian Trail crossing, I consoled myself that I could at least pick up a cold Coke or two at its soda machine. Every motel has a soda machine, right? I returned to the trail crossing and walked into the parking lot. No soda machine. I rejoined the AT, my lower lip quivering like the San Andreas Fault. 3 miles later, I was at Affinity Pond. The next good water on the trail was more than 8 miles ahead, so I settled for bad water and pitched my tent for the night. I was not about to drink pond water without boiling it for several minutes. I was forced to drink hot chocolate with my meal, although it was another very warm night. There is nothing like a cup of hot chocolate at the end of a long, steamy day. The pond next to which I'm camped is beautiful, which makes up for several small disappointments. Tomorrow night, I'll be in Dalton, Massachusetts, which makes up for a great deal more. The town has a community centre at which they allow backpackers to stay free of charge. It has a few luxuries which seem absolutely decadent to me right about now, and the town has restaurants. It's all about 15 miles away. I need something like that to look forward to because I hear that it will rain tonight and all day tomorrow. Luck has not been a lady to me today.